Okay, so Paul, how's it going?
Not bad. I've gone through the reading, the Mike Long for this module. Looked at the video of Glenn Fulci, which is really useful. And now I've got to get down to start designing the test, I suppose.
Yeah, well, if you can, obviously, yeah, I think it would be good to, try, because obviously it's a good way of seeing what you're up against and if you can get it. To me, the biggest kind of question about it is the transferability of if they can do the criterion-based test we give them, what does that say about their ability to do either sort of a more generalized version or even the version itself? So if you give someone a question about find your way from A to B, how transferable is the fact? I mean, it's better than the other kind of tests of it, but it still has its questions. That's one area. How transferable is it? And the second area, of course, is to what extent do you factor in accuracy, complexity, fluency as measures of their ability? So it's one thing Mike was always quite insistent on was this kind of, it's like a driving test. You can do it or you can't. But on the other hand, a lot of people say, well, but we want to know how well you can do it, for translators and so on. It's not good enough to say, well, yes, I can translate from Spanish to English. But obviously there you need to say, well, can you do it in this, according to these specifications?
Yeah, the problem I had with Mike Long's definition was he seems to be against building constructs, and just like the final exit test should be the point where you decide, oh, this person can do it or not, and he's kind of against building constructs. But I spoke to my wife about this, and said, well, there's always a construct anyway, whether you admit it or not, even if you do have a pure task as the final assessment, then there's obviously going to be some constructs underlying it anyway. So that's my problem. Like, and also that my problem is like the actual doing of it. How do you transfer? This is more with Glenn Fulci's thing about how does it look like to go through the process of arriving at going through the test specifications and parsing, and how does that work? Would be also my question.
I think Glenn Fulter was very absolutely right about that. It's exactly how do you do it? And of course, if you're interested, as a lot of people are, in some measure, I mean, it's all very well saying we're against mass proficiency tests like the Cambridge assessment ones or the ones that Pearson's doing now, and although that's pretty obviously, or it's easy to say what's wrong with them, but it's still the case that universities, for example, want to know, is this foreign student likely to be okay on the course or not? In which case, if you say, well, just because he got whatever the score is in the IELTS doesn't is not a reliable measure, fair enough. But what do you do? Do you have to have a specific test for each department in the university? If you're studying maths or you're studying physics or whatever it is you study, and even there, is that too general? Do you need to say, oh, well, you're doing, I don't know, quantum physics, and I'm doing another kind of physics? So I think, I was rather, unsatisfied with what we've got on assessment. And I was saying to Neil, I think we need to look into it more carefully. And it's not an area that I think Mike looked at in any detail in that book. And of course, it's too late to ask him now how he would, build on it. So I think, the idea first, I think the criticism is valid. That, that's always the safest bit. You could say, I don't know the best way to do it, but I'm, at least I know that, that there are serious problems with the proficiency tests as they exist. And I think those need to be emphasized just because they're so hugely influential, Did you see that stuff about South Korea, the English frenzy?
No.
I put that up somewhere on the blog about it. It got very ruffled feathers in South Korea. All the people teaching there who are on Twitter got really quite upset. But there's quite a lot of, there was a documentary, I think it was on BBC, following, the academic one is Park, 2010, did an investigation of the effects of the washback effects of this huge exam in South Korea. And as a follow-up, I think it was the BBC, some British TV company went there and did a documentary on it. And it is absolutely harrowing, What happens is there are over 100,000 hogwons, I think they're called, which are cramming schools. Mm-hmm. In South Korea, they spend more than $15 billion on English, private English. And the vast majority of it goes to pay for these cramming schools. And what they do is they prepare students in South Korea for a university entrance exam. And the university entrance exam is graded so that only the best scores get a chance of going to the best universities. And English is a kind of pivotal part of the test. So they did a thing showing these people, they do 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds doing 15 and a half hour days.
Jeez.
Yeah, getting 5 hours sleep. In an absolutely appalling state, lots of suicides and breakdowns and, and that this, when it comes time for the exam, that the sale, the city sort of comes to a standstill. Everything stops so that they can do these mad exams. So there, what Glenn and others saying, and now here's Washback at its craziest, the exam itself, the English exam is appalling. It's multiple choice. It's grammar based. It's testing sort of metalinguistic knowledge, not whether you can use the language for communicative abilities, and so on. So the whole thing is a nightmare, and it's just a kind of very stark example of what's wrong with the tests that we use. So extrapolating from that, although it is a very extreme example, one can say that the uses to which the IELTS test and the TOEFL test are put are appalling. So they're used, for example, in Australia, the IELTS was used for immigration. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be an academic, to see if you're ready to do a university course, and there it's being used to for political purposes to say sorry, you can't come in as an immigrant, as a and so on and so on. So I think that kind of criticism that Mike goes into a bit in his chapter on assessment, that's well taken. And I think it needs to be said more, because it does seem to be general acceptance of particularly the Cambridge assessment people, who are the biggest players. TOEFL in America claims to be the biggest, but apparently the Cambridge assessment is now, you know, they're collaborating with the Chinese, they're collaborating in Japan, and so on. So the influence of Cambridge assessment is huge, you know. Now, you could say that their bank of proficiency, you know, what is it? PET, TEC, but this is what they used to be. I don't know what I think, for example.
NCAS, yeah.
Yeah, first certificate English is now, I think it's called B2 or something. And it's, but anyway, you know, that I think it goes from 5 levels. Well, at least you could say those include an interview, which, you know, has some kind of validity as a test of people's ability to communicate. And do you reminds me of this famous video of somebody being interviewed on, have you seen, it went viral, millions and millions saw it in a few days. It was some high up honcho, some CEO was interviewed by, and again, BBC or ITV, like this, as a video thing. And he was trying to, you know, give his opinion on some, you know, matter of business, and saying the government needed to, I don't know, you know, reduce wages or pay people at the top more, some madness. And he was going, and his two kids, well, one of his kids came in through the door, like your the person that just opened the door there. And a kid toddles in, goes up to him, and he pushes him away. He almost sort of flattens her. And then another kid comes in, and one of those sort of waddly things, you know, the wheelies that do. And then this, the maid, the Filipino maid, comes running in and grabs them both. You know, I mean, it's absolutely, it's just shocking, you know, the way that, anyway.
So, it's the magnetism of Zoom. Everyone wants to be attracted to Zoom, mess up the course.
I would have thought, you know, that, I mean, it went by and said, that's the way these people behave. You know, this hugely important person was absolutely embarrassed to the core. Couldn't
he shooed him out the door, didn't he? He just said, I'm busy. And yeah,
he tried to, but then there's the maid rushes in, incredibly embarrassed that it's, you know, and gets rid of them for him. But he, to him, you know, his whole world collapsed around him. And they said, oh, the shares plummeted in the company. Well, good show. Anyway, back to testing. There is some validity, it seems to me, in the Cambridge thing, in to the extent that it does an interview. Now, what they've done in the IELTS, that's got an interview, but it's gone down to 4 minutes now. And it's done online. Oh, no, yes, it is. It's done online. There's only one examiner, and there's a prompt. I think there used to be 4, and now there are 3. The first one is something like, say something for a minute about something. And another one involves some kind of attempted interaction. But in any case, the whole thing now is less than, I think it's 7 minutes, or something like that. And whereas in the TOEFL test, that's done with a computer. The computer gives the prompt. The student has, I think, a minute to prepare, and then gives the answer. And the answer is recorded, of course, because it's done like this, you know, people have got their, and it's recorded. And it is marked partly by a computer and partly by people at home who have no, they're not necessarily qualified in any way to teach English or have any qualifications. They're told, listen to this and this and this. And those are the tests on the basis of which enormously important decisions are taken, you know, all over the world, but particularly places like South Korea and Japan and so on, Vietnam increasingly apparently. These are kind of life-changing exams that these people are doing. So the question is then, you know, how does one replace them with the kind of test that Mike and others suggest? Glenn is much more, I mean, Mike is pretty, not exactly dogmatic, but pretty forcefully, you know, insists on this kind of driving test sort of thing. They can do it or they can't.
That's fine for lower levels, like a traffic stop or a driving test. But
yeah,
my learners, for example, are not homogenous. I might have a Chinese person studying law and a German student studying biology, someone studying English literature in the same class. And it doesn't work to have the driving test model, I don't think, for that situation.
Right. What do you do then?
Well, if I'm teaching, we have this, our own version of a university, of IELTS, let's just say, but it's only for German universities and it's called UniCert. But it's kind of, it has its positive aspects in that the assessment, most of it's decentralized to the university. So you have a lot of flexibility in your own workplace. The other thing is, the problem with it is it's not very well theoretically or maybe not theoretically driven. There doesn't seem to be a lot of academic evidence behind it. So you're kind of swimming in your own pool. You have to make it up. All the universities do it their own individual way, which has its own disadvantages. So, that's what I basically teach. But
do they expect you to do some kind of test?
Well, no, the UniCert test is like the test that you do if you want to do a master's in Germany. So you need, it's basically a C1 test, and then it's accepted at all the universities.
Right.
It's like an entry exam, a gatekeeping exam for a master's.
For a master's, that's interesting.
And that's the really important qualification now, because a BA is not enough.
Right.
So many students need to go on to do a master's. So
And your students are mostly interested in doing masters, or
I mean, that's what they would do the UniCert exam for, is to, so they can take that piece of paper and take it to another institution and do a master's there.
Yeah.
If they want to stay at my university at Humboldt, they can do the internal. They just have a certificate. But if they want to go anywhere else, in Germany, they often need the UniCert, the transferable qualification.
And is that, do the German universities recognize IELTS or TOEFL or any of the high stakes proficiency tests?
I mean, you can see why, for the reasons you've mentioned, why a country would want to set up their own system. So the UniCert is their own system, but some of them do obviously, I think, maybe recognize some of the other systems as well. There's a big list. Yeah, and they do recognize them as well, but German students also sometimes prefer to have the UniCert. Yeah. But it's often with teachers that they know, it's a setting that they know, and they're not going to leave Germany. So why would they need to do anything else
that might
even be a bit harder?
Although I doubt it. Well, who knows? I don't know what their German standards are like. So what are in your situation, how do proficiency levels figure in your work? Do people talk about, I think you're B1 or A, all that stuff in the CEFR, or do they talk about, I think you're lower intermediate, or how do people see their level of English?
I mean, the washback effect is not just for students, it's also for teachers. So for example, the interface where we enter our grades into the system, the grades at the end of the semester, is like four or five blocks, and the given grades inside the computer are the skills. So you have speaking, listening, reading, writing, and systems. So
systems
is basically grammar. But it could also be Lexis. But that's the interface that you have to do, and you just choose whichever variation you want. So one course might be speaking, one course might be just writing, but that's what you choose from. It's a very kind of skills-based approach, proficiency approach of separating all the skills out. That's how I think most teachers work at my institution anyway, in other languages too, not just English.
Right. So you're teaching university, basically you're doing EAP, are you?
Yeah.
And you're doing it for people who are still undergraduate, but they want, a lot of them will no doubt want to go on to do masters.
Yep, they do, yeah, increasingly, man, yeah.
So they've got an eye on this internal national exam that's the gatekeeper for masters.
Yeah, in German universities, there's obviously a language center, which is often a language center, which is semi-separate from the main university. And students go there either to take credits towards their main course, they can get credits, or they take it for the gatekeeping exam, which in our case is the UniCert. But we also do TOEFL preparation as well. There's a few courses on that too.
The TOEFL is the now completely computer-based.
It's all done in a room with just computers, basically. Yeah. Someone leads them through exercises, and there's just a bank of computers that they work on. That's it.
Yes. That's a big industry here in Spain or everywhere, because it's, you know, it's what they used to be, until everybody's got their own laptop now or tablet, whatever they got. That a room of computers where people are banging away at these tests with one or two teachers roaming around helping as needed, and that's it. The whole bloody thing is done. You respond, you listen and respond. You the grammar is done like that. The listening, the reading. Even now, the speaking is, well, it's always, there's never been a face-to-face interview in TOEFL. So what I'm getting at here is in terms of testing and assessment, do you have a end of course or end of term or end of semester assessment process, or is it sort of ongoing?
Every teacher makes their own tests for their own courses, and if there are any students who in addition want to do the UniCert exam, maybe they want to do a master's or they want to go to another university, then they take the UniCert courses the week after all of our courses are finished. So there's an extra exam week for this kind of our equivalent of the IELTS. So it's on top of regular courses. But it's good in a way that teachers have control over their own courses, but it's bad in the way that if everyone's making mistakes, then those mistakes are going to be duplicated all over every assessment. So that's also a problem.
And who's your boss? Who guards the guardians?
Well, assessment has always been the teacher's own responsibility. There's no
even when we nobody have, you haven't got a boss no. who looks and says. Can I have a look at your test?
No.
Wow.
No, and it's been like that ever since I've been there. I've only been there for about 5 or 6 years now, freelance first and then employed, but teachers do their own tests and that's it.
Okay, so what are you going to do? Will the next test you do be influenced by sort of TBLT, a criterion reference performance type of test rather than a proficiency type of test.
Yeah, but can I just establish a few terms? So criterion reference is the criterion that you get from the needs analysis, is that right?
No, the criterion in any test would be that you set a pass-fail standard. In other words, it's not norm. There's norm reference and criterion reference. A lot of the testing is, if it's norm referenced, it means some of you got to fail. you know. So there is usually a sort of bell curve, so that this is the way, for example, in the UK, that university A-levels were done. They were norm referenced in the sense that a certain percentage had to get A plus and a certain percent and so on. In a criterion reference, you just say, what does a pass mean? And in that sense, the driving test is a good example of a criterion reference test. You can do this and this. You've got to do a 3-point turn, drive up, stop, etc., etc. And if you do it, you pass. And if you don't, you fail. So that's the difference between norm referenced and criterion referenced. You, as a tester here, would set your criteria. You would say, okay, for me, you pass if you can do this, and this.
Yeah, the only problem is I have to give a certain grade within the German system. I have to give a 1 is the highest and 4 is the lowest. And there's like 1, 1.3, 1.72. It goes like that and 4 is a fail. I am like obliged to give that system.
Yes. Well, now, you know, one would say either you just say, I'm just going to, whatever's a pass, they'll get that. And whatever's a fail, they'll get that. Or you take it seriously and you try and say, well, I think he or she did better than the, you know, Jones did better than Smith, and so Jones gets a 3.3 and Smith gets a 2.8.
Yeah, and I literally couldn't do a pass-fail test. I mean, I just think I'd get into trouble. If students failed, they would complain.
Right.
And I'd get into trouble.
Okay. So in that case, it has to be bandwidth, does it? Like A is excellent, B is very good, and so on. In my MA, for example, the course I do at Leicester, for each module, one of the modules is grammar and pronunciation, another is language learning, SLA, another is discourse and so on. So in each thing, they have to finish with 2-3,000 word papers. And those are graded, let's see now, what are they? Yes, 70 plus is a distinction. 60 to 70, merit. 50 to 60, pass. 40 to 50, fail. And 30 means you can't even take it. I forget what it means. I don't think I've ever seen anybody get that. So anyway, that's how it's done there. Right? You've got a pretty standard kind of way of doing things. Excellent, very good, good, fail. For example, 3 distinctions of pass and maybe 2 fail, something like that.
I mean, the problem for me is not the system, how it's actually calculated and kind of put through the Mensa machine is one thing, but it's how the actual test, what is it I would be testing? I'm setting up a module on a student journal.
Yeah.
So what would I actually be testing? Like I think meetings is the obvious one that comes to mind. Like having an editorial meeting would be one task.
I would think, you know, writing something. Is it the journal is text based, right? I mean, or is it multimedia?
No, they'll be coming up with for the first year. It would be coming up with a simple either digital or PDF journal, correctly formatted and all that kind of thing with different articles in it.
Right. And is that a collaborative task?
Yeah, it's totally collaborative. They'll be working together, and they'll be collaborating on the getting the content, putting call-outs together to different departments, sorting out the submissions, having meetings to decide the content, and publishing. So it would all...
Yeah, I think this is fantastic. Maybe just, you know, because Neil is recording it, let's just rehearse or remind us of somebody who might not know what you're doing. You've decided to base your course on, which is an EAP course for university undergraduates, on producing a journal. And you took your the idea from the United States, right, where a lot of universities have, in your opinion, very good, highly professional journals.
Yeah, they have a culture of journal making among undergraduates that they believe. It came from a report that as communication of research is an essential part of the research process, undergraduates aren't getting that practice in communicating their work because they're just writing to the teacher and that's where it stops, the process stops. So they have a culture of undergraduate publishing, and I think a lot of them are really good and it might work really well in Germany. So I'd try a pilot project here.
You've actually done it, haven't you? This term, or you're going to do it next term?
Next semester. It's like starts in like 3 weeks or something.
Ah, right.
So I need to plan it now.
Right. So you plan to put into to do a course. How long is a course? A semester?
It is 14. It's usually 15 weeks, but this time it'll be 14 weeks.
Okay. And how much contact time, teacher time, is that?
Only 2 hours a week.
2 hours a week, which is online these days, I suppose.
Yeah.
And they're expected to do a certain amount of work on their own?
Yeah, like maybe 2 hours a week maximum, to 2 hours a week.
Okay, good. So you're going to tell them, right, how many students are involved?
Up to 15. I'm usually around 8 to 10, I think, the core. Right.
So you're going to tell them at the beginning, right, this term, 14 weeks, you're going to work together to produce a journal. And obviously you'll show them examples of what you think are good journals. And then how will you kind of divvy up the work? Will you say, anybody particularly interested in graphics, anybody particularly interested in sport or anything like that? Or how will that go?
Yeah, so I'll have a week zero, which they come to the electronic interface, the learning management system, and a lot of the information will be there, the course syllabus, what we're going to do.
Right.
The first class will be start the ground running, hopefully, and I'll ask them, we'll talk about the identity of the journal, possibly. We'll start thinking about work groups, so I'll put them into work groups. If anyone's a brilliant graphic designer, they'll go in the design group. Right. And yeah, they'll start collaborating from week one.
Do you have groups sorted out, like reporting, editorial?
No, I mean, I've watched a few presentations on people who do these kind of journals, and really every person has to do virtually every job. So
That's good.
If you're an editor, then you might be writing the submissions as well. And I've got to tell them that in week one and prepare them for that. Okay. So it's going to be front loaded at the first few weeks because it has to be.
Right.
And then, but it's the middle part that I'm kind of thinking about. How do I actually get them into groups and keep the momentum going? And also the testing thing. What do I test them on at the end?
Right. So that's what I was leading to, really. They work on things, they collaborate, they produce. If you're lucky in the end or before the end, you'll get some journal. They'll have produced something, some extended text, which it takes the format of a journal, and they've all contributed to it.
Yep.
Then the big question is, who passes, who gets a 4, who gets a 3, who gets a 2, and who gets whatever the marks are.
Exactly.
You've obviously thought a bit about it, I don't suppose you've got the final answer quite sorted out, but how are you going to deal with the assessment?
I thought about having... What I'm really against is having a high stakes exam at the end, which tends to be how everyone's courses run. It just, the washback effect is dreadful, and the motivation tends to be really low until the 12th or 13th week when everyone starts getting interested in the exam. Yeah. So maybe I could have a series of like speaking exams where they are assessed on their ability to function in a meeting. Yes, that's really That's really how far I've got at the moment, like assessed meetings or mini meetings.
If it's a journal, doesn't that give you the opportunity to assess their written work, for example?
Yeah, they will get a mark for writing, will be the product, but the process, it all comes back to the construct. That's what I was thinking about the construct is, I mean, yeah. It should be some kind of construct that they can take forward into their kind of future working lives and their future. Let's just say they're going on to a master's.
Yeah.
You would hope they would have to collaborate, and even in their working lives, they'll have to collaborate. And those things that they learn in collaboration might be really useful.
Yeah, there are quite a few studies. Roger Gilbert's done one or two on EAP, putting Mike Long's sort of idea. So there, he started with doing a task analysis. So he said, okay, these people are going to be doing a master's. I'm not sure if he didn't take two or three different disciplines like medicine and engineering, and I don't know, I can't remember. He's a tremendous guy, Roger Gilbert. If you ever need to, he's very amenable to all of them doing the course. He'd be delighted to hear from you. So if anyway, his thing was you do a task, a needs analysis, you identify target tasks.
I've done that.
And you've done that.
Yeah, I sort of wrote away to lots of journals, and they've sent me back the target tasks.
For target tasks for writing a journal?
An undergraduate journal, yeah.
Right. One question there, obviously, is to what extent do the target tasks of writing a journal mirror or map well onto the needs of a German undergraduate who's going to be going to do a master's where he or she will need a certain command to do certain things in English?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, one thing that strikes me as kind of managing complexity, ordering information, producing a final, producing a written product through collaboration. These are all things that strike me, but I haven't really gone through the process of putting it all together yet.
Because I would have thought, to say, in order to produce a journal, they need they need to be able to do the following tasks. They need to be able to read stuff and get the gist. They need to be able to take part in a meeting. They need to be able to write a text and blah, blah, blah. That seems to me to be pretty manageable, to come out with six, seven, eight target tasks, which you then divide into pedagogic tasks. As I say, in a way, it's like almost like sort of content-based, in that you're getting them to do something we used to call this English through stealth. So, you're saying, right, we're going to build a boat. But what you're really doing is, helping them learn English. There's this new one. I don't know if you saw that. I've just been in contact with the co-founder. Two women in the north of England have done this thing called Heart and Parcel, where they do English through cookery. And most of their students seem to be from Pakistan, India, Asia, and they teach them English by doing cookery classes. And they're actually, the women are, in many cases, there are sort of cultural things involved, a lot of cultural things involved, like the place of a woman in the family and that kind of thing, and not having a job and staying among other women and being a bit isolated. And a lot. So what they do is they do these classes. They actually meet sometime before the COVID lockdown. They met and cooked together. They had communal meals and so on. And so only rarely did verb, noun, and stuff like that, or grammar correction, very little of that. Most of it was about cooking. And there, the criterion was they're very, very keen, apparently, on dumplings. Dumplings is the big thing. And it's who can make the best dumpling or the best dumpling dish. So there you have it. You've got a, you know, there's a good criterion-based test for you. How good is the dumpling? But really, underneath that, it's what happened, what language did they use to produce the dumpling? And that's the way that they're working to help these people learn English. So you might say a little bit like that. What you're doing is getting them to produce a journal. And one question is, how good is the journal? But sure. Underlying that, of course, is how good is their English for the purposes that they need it.
The other thing is, it also is an opportunity for them to show off their undergraduate work. So if they've done anything, I think one of the things I was thinking of, just we're looking for best work. So as an undergraduate, like, what's your best work? And good. Students would be able to pitch in either work they've handed in or work that they can adapt for an audience. And it's their best work. I mean, I'm trying to keep it as really simple as possible.
Yeah.
They only have 2 hours a week, 14 weeks.
Yeah.
Do I say to students, well, just pick the best thing that you've been working on and adapt it for an audience. And that would be, acceptable.
That sounds great. I like this idea. I think it's fantastic. In a German university, how important is English? Do they speak in English, for example? An undergraduate level, I imagine that there aren't that many foreign students there, are there?
Yeah, there are a lot now. There's a lot of Chinese students and also South Korean. So when you told me before about the South Korean exams, my students here, a few from South Korea had already told me, yeah, it's really high stakes there. It's a lot of pressure. And there's a lot of bullying too. Yeah. But everything's in German. So the main subjects.
Everything is in German. So there's the Koreans and whoever they are expected. There's not English as a lingua franca there.
No, so if you come to study there, if you study like one of the main subjects like law or medicine, it'll be in German. Yeah. But if you want to do a master's, especially in another university, then you need a qualification at C1 in English. So that's where they often come to us for a C1 qualification.
Ah, and they actually say C1, referring to the EFR scale.
Yep. They specify C1. Sometimes it's B2. They only need a B2. It depends what you're applying for and where. But oftentimes it's now C1 is the grade they need.
And what is evidence of a C1?
So there's usually a list. So it can be, I think maybe it can be IELTS or TOEFL, but or UniCert for German university. So that's where the UniCert comes in.
You reckon that the test at the end, I mean, are you allowed to do ongoing evaluation?
Yeah, we can do continuous assessment. We can do it any way we like. There's lots of leeway. So I can do continuous assessment, like a series of assessments. Yeah. But I wasn't really sure what they would be. So I thought maybe an editorial meeting or maybe a progress meeting or something like that would be good.
Yes, you could. Obviously, you have to warn them of this, right? You have to say, next week we're going to do something that will count towards your final grade.
Well, that's the problem. I have to specify everything at the start of the course.
Ah.
I can't just surprise them. Everything has to be planned out, like week one, week two, week three. I mean, I used to do it a little more fluid, but students really really appreciate knowing when everything is happening, more or less.
Yeah.
And when the tests are coming.
You just say, right, well, week four, there'll be a meeting and you'll be expected to do blah, blah, blah. And week seven, there'll be, I don't know what. And towards the end, you'll have to submit a text, for example, or and then maybe the in Long's approach, there's a series of pedagogic tests, and at the end there's something that is a simulation that gets as far as near as possible to the target task that inspired the pedagogic test in the first place. Does that seem to you, if you've got six or seven target tasks, does it seem in any way possible for you to design some kind of final task that would be some kind of simulation of the target task?
I mean, I suppose the exit task would be the journal.
Yeah.
And having some way of assessing that. I mean, on other courses I've done, I have a portfolio approach where students have to produce evidence. And I think that could be evidence of collaboration. So emails that you've done between you or something like that. That would be, they could produce five emails or five forum posts maybe. Because I mean, if it doesn't get assessed, it doesn't get done sometimes.
Yeah. Yes. Right.
So that might be another angle.
But maybe that, if you've got five or six, how many target tasks have you got?
I can't remember. I think it's like seven or eight, something like that.
Okay, so you might be able to get seven ongoing assessment exit task things that count. And then the final one would be, as you say, and we... 11, 12, 13, well, near the end, we'll have a final meeting where we'll put together the journal. And that will, be one of the seven ongoing assessment procedures. Maybe, I suppose you could even weight it if you wanted to. So this one's got double the weight of the, I don't know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I've just got to suck it and see, and the first time will be a pilot and see how it goes. And it, there's so many variables, like how many students you get. But it would
I hope you write it up, Paul. It would be very interesting to see this, see the course itself. I mean, I think it's good in a way that you're forced to bank, to say, okay, this is what's going to happen. You can't just wing it. This is how it's going to be. Now, of course, you can modify it slightly along the way, as long as you don't ruffle them too much. You can adapt to that word. But it'd be very good, to say, okay, this is what I started with, and then this is what happened, and then obviously these are my thoughts about it. Would make an extremely, I hope you keep a diary or something.
If I have time, yeah, I will.
yes, that's of course the problem. I just want to, this is the sort of last, I think it's relevant. I'm trying to get this last chapter of the book that I was writing with Mike together.
Mm-hmm. How's it going?
Thank you very much, incidentally, for your very interesting reply. I haven't... gone through them very, very thoroughly. I'm still going through Nick Broster, the Hands Up project guy. He sent me stuff, and this cooking one too is very, very interesting. But in any case, in your case, how do you see things going? You've done quite a lot already in Radical. You tried to set up the group at IATEFL. You've written on your blog and so on that you're obviously interested in Radical movements. I would ask Philip Kerr the other day, and he said it seemed to him that the question is, how do we change? How do we affect change? How do we get out of this commodified Hydra of ELT, which is course book driven, proficiency tested, CELTA qualified teachers, and so on, all that awful model. How do we change that? And Philip said, the trouble is it's mostly outside education. In other words, it's like, what do we do about neoliberalist advanced capitalism? That's why things are commodified, and you won't really get rid of that until you get rid of the underlying political organization. Do you see ELT as a profession, as an industry, as a being involved in teaching English? How are you optimistic about the possibility of change?
For me, the kind of inside-outside distinction isn't too much of an issue. I mean, the CELTA just came out of a qualification international house, came out of thin air, and it was a booming market. So I think basically what might need to happen is people set up alternative qualifications, frameworks, quality assurance things. It has to be kind of formalized. It's no good criticizing things, which basically involves, a lot of just shouting at people and criticizing them, which is fine up to a point, but you have to build something different.
Yeah.
So like, for example, the UniCert thing, if the UniCert qualification in Germany hadn't been built, then we'd all be teaching to the IATEFL or the TOEFL test. And whatever criticism you have, it just shows that you can build alternative systems. You just need the will, the patience, and all that kind of thing. Kind of institution building, building new frameworks. If you actually look at something like the Equals framework, it's like so bare. You could get a group of teachers, of like a hackathon where you worked in it for 48 hours solidly, and you could come up with something much better with just a group of teachers. It just takes a bit of application, I think.
Do you feel like you're in a group of teachers, like-minded teachers, or some people who think like you that we need alternatives, or are you a bit of a lone wolf?
Oh, in Germany, I'm kind of a lone wolf. Yeah. So you need it has to be operate on a global scale, because there really aren't that many people who want to really change things that much.
Yeah, I was obviously talking to Neil about this and the co-op that he runs, the SLB, and he, not surprisingly, thinks that one of the solutions, one of the ways of effecting change, is to form a co-op, a local co-op. And what seems to be, what Nick Buffer says, and what most of the people I've talked to say, first, we need to sort of decentralize, and that's one of the problems, is this, edicts from London or New York come around the world, and even they fly in these idiot gurus who tell you how to improve your PPP methodology. So he's quite rightly, I think everybody would agree, with local actions needed. And in for Neil, the local action is revolves around the co-op. For Nick, it revolves around volunteers and a global network of volunteers doing storytelling and theatre with the kids. And so on. So the question there is, are these just little, insignificant blotches on a nice, calm background where the global players don't really need to take any notice?
I mean, I've been really inspired by this. We do some reading and some research into kind of organizations that push things on a global level. And there's a really inspiring organization called INPUD, and it's the International Network of People Who Use Drugs. And they are
sounds good.
And they're like, it sounds like they're just, you know, maybe a bunch of lunatics, but they are a very formally recognized and well organized organization with aims, principles, a constitution, an office, and they're based around groups of real activists. There's some in Vancouver, some in New York, some in like hubs, basically. There are some hubs. In ELT, it would be Barcelona, for example. Yeah. And they're these hubs that are coming together.
Paul, what's it called? INPUD?
INPUD, I-N-P-U-D. I'll put it in the chat here.
Okay.
So INPUD, the International Network of People Who Use Drugs. And they push for change.
International Network of People
Who Use Drugs. And they...
INPUD.
And obviously, you're right that localism is an answer, but you need, in a globalized world, you need a global global voice too. It's not enough to have isolated local efforts, because you'll be swamped eventually by the global players, by the power of global networks and
yes. Obviously, in a good sort of anarchist sort of way, one would expect a network. One would expect the local people to, form representatives at a higher level and so on. Yes, of course, one needs to be connected to other people. This
INPUD.
I must look at that. Do they, you say they have meetings and conferences and so on. Is the mission statement, or whatever the purpose of it, to talk about drugs and to legalize them and so on, or is it actually an umbrella term for a sort of alternative view of social life, or
it's
a political agenda there?
Yeah, it's totally an agenda. They push for kind of a they promote the health and defend of the rights of people to take drugs. They challenge the stigma and criminalization of people. They lobby. They do a lot of stuff at a global level. I mean, it's basically a corresponding or coordinating group, but they do network with all these kind of nasty agencies, and they lobby them, and they put forward their point of view, and they have a kind of a seat at the table, however small that kind of seat is. And I interviewed a guy who did ethnographic work with him. I'm working on this book project, and he was like, he was really inspired by these people. It's not just in, it's like people all over the world, but they're special hubs. And he was like, wow, these people are really amazing what they're doing. And and like Vancouver is one of the places where treatment of drug addicts is, they have these centers and they do a lot of radical work there. So yeah, that's INPUD.
Do you think that's a kind of an example of issue politics?
Well, they're just an example of, I've never heard of it before, like a global organization that puts forward a radical point of view, but is organized. It's not like just when having a blog, it looks like a proper, a United Nations for people who take drugs, which is kind of impressive in a way, I think. If that could happen.
Neil?
Sorry, INPUD,
Paul's talking about this. Have you heard of them?
About who?
INPUD.
It's in the chat. It's this radical organization that represents people who take drugs. And it's an example of a global organization that lobbies for radical change.
Good. So you've really solved the problem of task-based assessment, and now you're moving on to solving
the drug problem, the drug war.
Moving on to far more interesting. No, I was just ending up by asking Paul for his opinion about alternative ways of doing ELT, like task-based TBLT, for example, and what he thought was he optimistic about it. And that got us all. I was saying, you, Neil, think that the answer is co-ops like the one you've formed. And of course, Paul says, well, yes, that's fantastic, but we need a network of them. Things can't stay at a local level. I say, the people I've talked to so far, like you and Nick, who's doing the Hands Up project, and now Carol, who's doing this cooking project, all emphasize the need to be local and to get away from the, you know, the kind of multinational global course book kind of stuff, yeah. And to deal in local context. And Paul said, yes, but, you know, you need it has to be connected. It has, you need a global presence. You need, you know, if you're going to get anywhere very far, then it has to be joined up.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You'd agree with that SLB ought to be in, you know, try to form networks and so on with other co-ops.
Yeah, it's on the rapidly increasing to-do list. But yeah, we need to make more efforts to hook up with other co-ops, starting with, I think, other Spanish ones. And just as I think that's the plan, just to start exploring how we could learn from each other. Maybe we could possibly support each other and spread the idea. I don't know if Paul commented on something in LinkedIn. There's a lot to fight against. They're now offering 20 euros an hour to freelancers for in-company classes in Barcelona. 25 was the going agency rate pre-pandemic. Already not very good.
It's down to 20, is it?
Well, there's one agency, I don't know, but I mean, it kind of really, I mean,
three years ago now, I went and gave a session for a school in Girona, and the teachers there, a mixture of native speakers and non-native speakers, they were getting 15 euros an hour.
Hmm.
And that was on a contract.
Yeah, well, that's probably still above average for contracted ELT workers. I think it's probably more like 13, 14 is the average.
Yeah. Incredible. And what's it like in Germany? Is it that bad?
You'll get between 15 and 20 at a language school, and you'll get 30 or 35 at a university.
Yeah.
Per hour as a freelancer.
Yeah.
And there's lots of desperate people on Twitter at the moment asking for work. There's lots of teachers who can't get work, who are scraping by and looking for online work with anyone. So
there is a new co-op who are starting a cooperativized online platform for teaching online. I mean, not like our platform, but, you know, for doing Zoom type classes. Which I think is a great idea. I just hate their name. What are they called again? Oh, it's a really shitty, cheesy name.
The Oxford School of English or something.
No, it's not that bad. It's not like that. It's, I'll try to find it and I'll forward it to you. But, you know, their heart seems to be in the right place, and they're the way that they describe themselves, they're obviously good reasons for what they're doing.
Well, to go back to testing, Paul reckons. We were talking a bit about his project to do a TBLT type course based on producing a university undergraduate journal, and we said that maybe one way of doing it for the assessment. He has to do assessment, of course. Everybody expects it. Mm-hmm. And the assessment can't be pass-fail. It has to be, you know, graded in three or four categories, you know. But Paul's got complete freedom. You can do portfolio, ongoing assessment, final test, anything you like. And we were looking at the idea of using exit tasks for it. He's got 7 or 8 pedagogic target tasks, which he'll develop into pedagogic tasks. And maybe the suggestion is that the exit task of each of the series of periodic tasks could count as one part of the ongoing assessment.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
So that would, but of course, that's all very well, that sounds marvellous, but you've got to do it. You've got to actually say, all right, that means whatever it means. And Paul, I said, I really have, because it's where he can't wing it. He's got to actually say to his students, this is what's going to happen in this 14-week course. Week one, week two, and so on, including how it will be assessed. Mm-hmm. So I just say, I hope very much that he will try, you know, keep track of it well enough to be able to report on it at the end and write it up one way or another. I just think it'd be fascinating to hear what happens.
Absolutely. And we're still keeping in mind this suggestion of Paul's to create some kind of journal ourselves to share these ideas. I think it'd be really good, even if we just do some blog posts or something like that, at least.
Yeah.
But there is interest. There is interest from other co-op members at the moment. It's just everyone's snowed under. So we've got our website facelift. Once that's done, I think that'll be the next thing we'll turn our attention to.
Well, Paul himself is pretty, you know, busy. So, and he won't have time to. I say keep a diary.
No, if this, I think it's a great idea to do a journal and. Maybe I'll keep a diary with an eye to producing a report of it afterwards for other teachers.
Great. Would be great.
Yeah, cool.
I think it really, I mean, if you're not an academic, if you're not trying to get an academic post, and writing up in an academic journal has no particular attraction for you. But I think in terms of producing, you know, for your own blog or with SLB, there's some way where we can all learn from what you do. You know, I mean, it just sounds such an interesting project that it'd be really good if you could find the time to tell us about it one way or another. I mean, another thing would be to, you know, have a podcast or a, you know, session on it, video conference or something.
Yeah. Listen, gentlemen, sorry, I need to go.
Yes.
Me too.
Yes, we're both we're ready to go. Paul, really great to talk to you. I really hope, but I'll be in touch with both of you, actually, because both of you give me answers to these questions. I'm working through everybody's answers. And once I've got it all, I'll send you what I've got. And I hope we can all, with Neil's technical help, meet up and talk about what you've all said.
All right.
Cool. Sounds good.
Great. Thanks, gentlemen.
Good luck, Paul. Keep in touch.
Take care, guys. Will do.
Bye-bye.
Adios. Ciao.
Ciao.